This is Mike Fleet, recorded at the Hope Bay Reunion in Coniston by Chris Alden Lee on the 20th of October 2009. Mike Fleet.
Name is Michael Fleet, no middle name. Date of birth 4440. Nice easy one. And place of birth Ickleton, near Cambridge, near where the Imperial War Museum is. Used to go and see the planes at Duxford.
What kind of education did you have, Mike?
Well, normal primary, then two grammar schools, Woodley Hill Grammar School and Andover Grammar School, Southampton University, degree in geology. And having got the degree in geology, that's when I got the job with Bass.
Why geology? What was it that...
I felt like I was an outside type and felt like travelling and seeing the world, and that seemed to be a good place of doing. Well, you know, I didn't envisage the Antarctic when I started doing, or chose geology. I thought more in terms of crawling up streams in Africa looking for diamonds and things. But, so
you wanted adventure, the Rider Haggard experience.
Well, that's the sort of thing, yeah. No, sit back in the office at home. I didn't want that. I wanted to be out and about in the countryside.
So the doctorate is not a medical doctor?
Oh, not a medical, no. No, when I got back from Bass, I went to Birmingham University to write up my work as a scientific report, number 58, I think it was. And I did a parallel PhD, which was similar, but not quite the same. Some things I could say in the PhD, but I couldn't say it in the scientific report, but they're essentially the same thing. So that's where that came from.
What's your first memory of having anything to do or knowing about the Antarctic?
I suppose the first time was I saw Scott of the Antarctic when the film came out.
John Mills.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. And that was back in 1948, I think. And I'd have been 8 years old then. But I remember going to see that.
What impression did it have on you then?
I can't really remember very much about it. Lots of snow and ice, I think, and that was about it. And I think I was too young to really appreciate it. I just remember going to see it. It didn't sort of affect what I wanted to do later on, I don't think. I just carried on as I was.
So how come you did go to the Antarctic? What was the process that got you there?
Well, I think I just took my finals, not got the result. And, what's his name? Can't think of his name. He came round, Bill Sloman. Yeah, I'm getting a bit fuzzy like that. But
that's okay.
Yeah.
Don't worry about the details.
No, that's all right. Bill Sloman came round and gave a chat at Southampton University. And I think it's mainly to the geology, probably geography departments as well. And I went along and saw all the pictures of snow and ice and everything. And to be honest, I took it in. It was interesting. And then one of my other geological co-students said, I might as well have a go at that. And there were application forms there. I might as well pick one up. So I did, sent it off, got the interview and got the job. And I wasn't quite sure what I was going to at that stage.
Did you know where it was?
Yeah, I knew where the Antarctic was. Yeah, I knew it was down there rather than up there. And I knew that much. Yeah, no, I knew where it was. Okay, no problem.
What do you remember of the interview?
There were three. Ray Adey was one, he was a geologist. And one other did the talking, I think that's Bill Sloman, and a third one who didn't say anything. And I always assumed he was some sort of psychologist, because to do this work as a geologist, you need to have experience in geology, or a degree in geology. You need that, the professional qualifications. But I suspected he was quietly sitting around, how's this bloke going to get on with a dozen or so other people in a hut cooped up all winter? I think that's what he was there for. But they did ask me, you know, had I been to various places, and I hadn't done all that much. My parents never had very much money, so I couldn't do very much in the way of travel. And so I explained that, well, you know, I lived in the country and found that I found all my interest in that. I didn't need to go to places to find more interest. I think it proves that I can occupy myself. I'm not dependent on other things or other people keeping me amused and interested. I'm a bit of a loner, I suppose, in that sense. But presumably they thought I'd got the right sort of character to go on a Antarctic trip.
I guess
trip.
They were trying to spot any extremes of character.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I thought about, I belong to clubs now and you get extreme people in there and think, no, he wouldn't be, so, I wouldn't want to go south with him.
Yeah. So did you get to know Ray Avey in your time?
Oh, yeah, because before I went, the first thing I did was go to Birmingham University for 3 months, initial training. And so he was there and he was training me, in inverted commas. I think when that training started up, they did have a bit of, they were shown a bit of practical dog sledging. I remember people talking about the dog grips and a bit of plane tabling. I didn't do any of that. I just remember he just kept on bringing, you know, the classical books to read. So I was just reading books. He didn't seem very keen on me talking to the other geologists because I think he wanted me to go down as a fresh graduate and not be influenced by what had gone before me. So I'd get the fresh ideas coming out. Mm. Yeah, that's how I interpreted that.
What sort of man was Ray Avey?
Oh, very, very precise, and especially with grammar. You know, things like when I was writing a report, you want to put, say, the Hectoria Glacier. He didn't like the there. It was always Hectoria Glacier, not the Hectoria Glacier, and punctuation, things like that. He's very fussy about that. It was good, though, because the output was good.
So he was precise in other ways, was he?
Yeah, he's very precise, yeah. And one thing I remember, not nothing to do with being precise, he had me in a room at the university separate, and he always used squeaky shoes. I always knew when he was coming. He had these squeaky shoes. He walked quite fast, and he had these squeaky shoes. So I'd, you know, put the magazines away and get the Antarctic book out. That's one thing that sticks.
Before you went south, did you have a clear idea of what your brief was? Your job brief.
I knew I'd be going down to do some sort of geological mapping. I don't think I was told precisely you will do this particular area. Possibly the reason was that I left England in October, and so the previous people were still working there and working through the summer. So he wouldn't have known just how far they'd got. So he couldn't say, well, they've got to this point, and you carry on from that. So he wasn't in a position to do that before I left. But when I got south, I think, I'm just, at some stage I had a letter or a note saying, note of instruction saying what I was to do.
Was this one you opened on the ship?
No, I don't think I did before, until I got there. I'm a bit hazy on that though.
Right, it was sealed instructions then?
I'm just trying to think. It might well have been sent down by radio, because what I was saying, that the others were still working, and so he couldn't finalise the ideas. I got a feeling it may well have been sent by radio and to the base leader at the time, and I got it that way. I think that's what happened.
Good. So what did you find yourself doing in your, certainly, say, in your Hope Bay seal?
Yeah, OK, well, as a geologist, my job was to go to an area and put the rocks on the map. So I'd take, one bit would be granite, this will be Trinity Peninsula series, this will be Jurassic volcanic, so you end up with a nicely coloured map and work out the relationships of one to the other, you know, which is on top of the other, even though, you know, on the ground they're laid out horizontally, but one may go under the other. So you had to work that out and work out the geological history of what was going on. So that was my main work. It was a reconnaissance, because the map was largely unfilled at that time. People had been down the coast, but I went up into the glaciers and sort of went into the side of, or into the centre of the peninsula. Yeah, the peninsula's 5,000 foot thing, and so there's not any means of crossing over where I was working. That's why I went to Hope Bay and Stonington and worked from one to the other, rather than going to somewhere like Bay Seff, which was well, perhaps certainly a lot closer, but you had to get over the top, and that wasn't practical.
So the job was identification?
Identification of rocks, yeah.
Were you collecting samples?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, I relied on that quite heavily because the way the work was done, I'd go up with the dogs, go up the side of a glacier and just grab a sample, really. Just grab a sample, look at that little bit, and then move on to the next exposure and grab another sample. And in fact, I worked it out afterwards that at the time I was there, I only actually spent 14 days when I was standing in front of a chunk of rock, hammer in hand. The rest of the time was all spent travelling or lying up or on base because I couldn't start. So in that sense, it was very inefficient. So having grabbed the sample and got worked out what that was, that's when it went back to Birmingham University and it got torn to bits, sliced up and put under the microscope, ground up and analysed chemically, and you know, plot graphs and identify the individual minerals. So that's what I was doing when I got back. And then put the whole lot together as a hopefully coherent story.
So it's quite a long process then. You were out in the field the first 2 years collecting the bits.
Yeah.
And then you had 3 or 4 years back at university going through the bits.
That's right. I got back in 64 and I was doing that until April 67.
So we'll come to that a little bit later on.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Just trying to get the broad picture.
Hmm.
So were you able to do much in the way of analysis actually on base at Hope Bay or indeed at Stonington?
Not chemical analysis. We did have a means of making thin sections to put under the microscope, but that was a very tedious method. I think I made a couple, but it involves cutting the rock, sticking it onto a sheet of microscope slide, and grinding it down until you get precisely the right thickness. And that's a lot of work.
So the light would come through it?
So you can, yeah, the light comes through it and you use something called cross polarizers, which changes the polarization of the light. And you, according to the mineral, it reacts differently and you get different colours and helps you identify what the actual minerals are.
Were you having fun?
Oh, very much so, yeah. Yeah, I've often thought about hearing how people do it now. No, thanks. Well, I probably would if I was starting from scratch, but no, if I had to choose between doing it in the 60s when I was there and doing it the way they do it now, there's no contest. I'd certainly do it the 60s way.
Yeah.
It's so much more exciting. But I did have free time as well, which is another thing that I don't think people going down have anything like the same amount of free time to explore. You know, I learned photography and enjoyed watching the wildlife, that spent a fair bit of time doing that.
Did you find any geological surprises, or was it all very much as you might have imagined?
The only thing I comment to that sort of question is I did find about half an inch of coal and a little bit of copper, but not really, no. Found some fossils out on the eastern end of Robertson Island, which is right out the far end of the Seal Nunataks.
What were the fossils, do you know?
I can't remember the names. I went off to the British Museum to be identified. They were Cretaceous fossils. So I'd already deduced that they were Cretaceous because they link in with the Snow Hill Island and Seymour Island fossils there. There's some Cretaceous sediments along there.
And did the coal come as a surprise, or had you already worked out that it was going to be there somewhere?
No, I wasn't expecting it. It was within a sequence of Jurassic volcanics, which isn't the normal thing for coal, but I assume there's it wasn't lava, it was the, I called them in those days ignimbrites. They were when the volcano goes off, it sends a cloud of gases and gust and the mineral fragments, and they come rolling down the hill. It was a lot of those. I identified those by the way the crystals were broken up, and it was in that. So I think it probably may have come down on something like a bit of a peat bog, or maybe just a forest. You know, there's a forest there and you get this hot ash coming down, flattening the lot, and no oxygen, so it wouldn't burn, and presumably just carbonised.
But the concept that the Antarctic was once tropical, was that commonly held by the time in the 60s when you were there? Was this a new theory emerging whilst you were doing
it? No, I think Well, Hope Bay was famous for Mount Flora and the fossil plants there, so I certainly knew about that before I went down. That came out very early, so no, I don't think that was a new concept. But at university, when I was doing geology, we were talking about continental drift, which is now plate tectonics. So the idea of the continents moving around had been put forward well before I went south. But exactly how they collide and one goes under another and you get the, you know, Pacific Rim of Fire, that I don't think that had really... It was just beginning to come out as I graduated. And I could see how the tectonics were affecting the peninsula, for instance. You just look at the shape of it. It's curved.
Yes.
And if you look at the bit that goes up to South America, you come to the end of the peninsula and you go around South Georgia, South Sandwich Islands, and back to South America. You can envisage something being pushed through.
Yes.
So I could envisage that, just as a layman, actually. But I tried to incorporate that in my PhD by explaining the rocks, why the rocks were where they were.
Why was this work so important? I mean, obviously it produced a PhD for you, but was there a greater importance than that?
Well, I did wonder about the political side of things in those days.
Can you elaborate?
Yeah, whether... with anything like this, there's always a possibility of finding minerals or oil. And, I think the main thing was, claim on the Antarctic. Because the Argentinians and Chileans also claimed almost the same sectors as us. And I think it was at least quite a bit of it was occupation. Certainly with the Argentinians and Chileans, from what I saw, they were simply army units sent there to occupy it and perhaps took a few meteorological obs, and that was it. But at least I think Bass did have a strong scientific program, and also it's been developed to what it is now, which is a world leader, as far as I can tell.
So the theory was if you knew what the rocks were, you had a better claim to the land?
I think that was an excuse for being there. we weren't quite so blatant about just going there, sending people to be there, as the Argentinians and the Chileans.
You mean we were being British, were we?
Yeah. there is a research side. You know, we always want to explore anyway, and we were genuinely exploring the place. So, but it's a case of where the money comes from. And I think having a possible claim, I think that's what produced the money.
So you didn't meet any Chilean or Argentinian geologists, then? They weren't doing that?
Not geologists, no. There were, probably come across it already, but there was an Argentinian base right next to us at Hope Bay, and we saw them, but they were mainly army personnel. And didn't do all that much, I don't think. No, I think they had a pretense of doing a little bit, but not to the same level or standard that we did.
How did you decide when you were doing the field work?
Yeah.
With the dogs and tent and presumably a GA with you?
Yep.
How did you decide where to go?
Well, the first year I was with Tony Edwards, who was a surveyor, and he'd been to the same area before. So I was largely dependent on him. He knew, I needed to get to as much rock as possible, so he largely took control of that and decided where we'd go. Right, well, we'd go up so-and-so glacier, and we'd go up so-and-so glacier, and I'd stop off and get the rock. So it's largely under his control. Second year, when I was the experienced person, and I chose where I wanted to go and planned it myself. So,
by definition, though, it must have been rather hit and miss. You can only go where you can actually get to.
Oh,
the
rocks. Yeah. Some places I just couldn't get to.
So were you joining up the dots back at the hut?
Partly that, but we were issued with binoculars, and called binocular geology. You know, you stand back and see the rocks a mile or two away, and to some extent you can identify the rocks through binoculars. Like there was a red granite and a white granite, which are obviously white and red, so you could pick those out. And the Trinity Peninsula series was a dark colour and probably folded, and the Jurassic volcanics tended to be horizontal. So to some extent you could hazard a reasonable guess at what there was 2 miles up the glacier that you couldn't get to. Mm. So there was some of that as well.
You spent 2 years doing that, one at Hope Bay and one base at Stonington.
Yeah.
Similar work?
Yeah, it just continued where I left off, except I'd had the previous year's experience and got a better feel for it. But I did feel afterwards, because one of the things Bass did, most people were only taken on for, you know, 2 winter contract, and I was. And then after that, nice knowing you. Which I thought if I went down again, I'd do a much better job because of my previous experience. Mm. Or even if I could go back to some of the areas that I'd visited. Now, you go to a rock face and think, what on earth is this? And then you go a bit further along and you take it in context of the whole area rather than individually. Oh, yeah, that must be so-and-so. And how nice it would be to go back with that in mind. But I couldn't actually do that.
Was that a frustration?
It was, yeah. Because I don't like, you know, when I was writing it up, you know, I like to be more sure than perhaps I was. Remember, the very first rock I went to, you know, it was a miserable, dark, grey day, and sledge pulled up and walked 100 yards or so over to the rock and got this chunk. What the hell is it? I took a specimen and did work it out afterwards, but if I'd gone to the area again, I'd know, oh yeah, this is a bit of the Jurassic, and you've got that background to start with, but when you start with a completely blank canvas, it's sometimes difficult.
And you were fresh out of university, weren't you?
Oh, I was, yeah. Yeah, first job.
No previous experience?
Well, part of the training was we did go out and do geological mapping, but not in ice and snow. It did.
Why were Bass so keen on new recruits, on new graduates? Why didn't they go to hoary old geologists who knew a thing or two?
Well, I think two theories on that. One is that they wanted fresh ideas, and the other one is new graduates are cheaper. I think that.
Well, we'll come back to the Antarctic shortly, but I'm interested to follow this through now. So,
yeah.
At the end of your second winter, second season,
yeah.
you came back,
yeah.
And all your specimens had arrived safely.
They did get back, yeah, surprisingly, because I did have to leave some to be flown out, and they did actually catch up with me.
Describe the environment you were working in at Birmingham University. What was it like?
Oh, it's I suppose classic university, old style university. We were in research room 1, and Ray Adey was along the corridor, had his own office. So there were, I don't know, 5 or 6 of us all in research room 1. There's a drawing office, and I eventually married the girl in the drawing office. It didn't last too long, but that's a fact that happened anyway. And so we all gathered round our microscopes there. Oh, well, we'd also, if we were grinding up the rocks for doing the chemistry, we did that ourselves, actually. We had to get the sample, put it through the grinder, sift it out, and then dissolve it in hydrochloric acid and all sorts. That was all done by us personally. I suspect nowadays there are specialists that
did
that.
Why was it done by you? Lack of anybody else?
I think so, yeah. Mm. But nowadays you've got all sorts of machines that will produce the same information in a fraction of the time. Mm. But they weren't available.
So you were chemically analysing the rocks?
Yeah. And what I was trying to do, certainly with the granites, what are called triangular diagrams. You plot out, I forget just what they are, probably sodium, potassium and silicon. Anyway, 3 points in the diagram. And for each rock, it plots in one part of the triangle, and you get another rock, and it plots in another part. And you put all of them on, and what you're looking for is either they all plot in the same place, in other words, they've got the same origin, or they form a line, which means that the rocks are progressing with time. Mm. And with something like a granite, which is a liquid, it does that because it is crystallising, and some of the crystals drop out and the composition changes. So that's the sort of thing I was looking at. And it might be a granite, looking at the granites, which are underneath volcanoes. You've got granite, and which is a magma, and when granite erupts as a lava, comes out the top, then what you can do is get a sample of the lava, put it on the same diagram and say, yes, that lava is related to the granite. So that was the sort of thing I was looking for there.
You were still employed by FIDS at this point, or were you back at
it was Bass then.
Bass, you were still employed by Bass.
I was employed by Bass, yeah. Okay. And I was a registered PhD student.
Were there moments when you still didn't quite know what you had in front of you?
No, I think by then I got a pretty clear idea what I was doing, and the report came through. Of course, I had the other people around me to, you know, if I did have any queries. So.
And were you still having to make educated guesses where the white bits on the map were, where you hadn't?
Yeah, I suppose one spot, yeah, you do. Well, we also had aerial photographs, which helped. So you get one sample from the bottom, and then you get the aerial photograph out, and you can see, well, that block of rock is all the same thing. And then what was perhaps more of an educated guess is where to put the fault lines. And you do that by, you've got a block of rock there, a block of rock there, and you have a snow gully, and fault lines tend to erode preferentially. So you get a gully, and if the two blocks are quite different, then you tend to say, well, that's probably a fault line. So that was a bit of an educated guess.
But you were able to colour the whole map in, you weren't leaving white patches.
Well, there were white patches where there's too much snow cover. Mm. So, like the glaciers, you could do the sides of them. And in some cases, you could go across, yeah. But the glaciers themselves are big gullies and are likely to be, because the ice finds the line of least resistance, like water, and a fault line tends to be where the rock is broken up. That's the line of least resistance. So the glaciers probably follow a fault line anyway.
So was the peninsula heavily faulted then?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's plenty of faults around. Yeah, well, it's been crushed by the orogenic movement, so that's not too surprising.
Let's take you back to the Antarctic, and I'm always interested in things that went wrong. Were there any close calls?
Yeah. Well, all the crevasses.
All the crevasses?
Well, lots of... Well, actually, that's probably the worst part of it, with crevasses. I'm never quite happy when crevasses are around, so close calls. I mentioned a couple, I think. One was going up Bill's Gulch. That's just opposite Stonington. It's on the east coast, and with a name like that, it had to be named by the Americans. But we'd done the depot run, and we were coming up, and because it was a depot run, we had three dog teams, and we're trying out Eliasson motor toboggans for the first time. They're used all the time now, but these were rather pathetic little things, but we were using them. So there's a convoy coming up. Three dog teams went up the glacier first. I was with the first of the Eliassons, and it got bogged down, and it was quite a common occurrence, and I sort of set to and just pushed it out, and oh yeah, crevasse. And, you know, you get the blue hole down there and carried on. The next one came along. The Eliasson got over, but the crevasse bridge collapsed underneath it. And it was, I don't know, 10, 12 feet wide. And the two sledges jackknife like that. And there were two people on that. It was Pete Kennett with the Eliasson. Tony Marsh ended up, you know, in this jackknife position.
They're in a V-shape, weren't they?
In a V-shape with the gaping hole underneath him. And
how did you get him out of that?
We did. I think we probably held the sledges and he just climbed up and out. I can't quite remember now. But, you know, that was a near miss. It could have been me gone down quite easily.
Is that the one near Stonington?
Near Stonington, yeah.
Tell me about the Eliassons, because this was new technology, wasn't it?
It was new, yeah. Yeah, they'd been sent down to us to try out, and I think they went to Halley Bay as well. And we got these things, and we played around with them. First of all, we had them on Adelaide Island. I don't know if I put that in there, but my middle summer, I went to Adelaide Island. I suppose this is a failure in a way. Went to Adelaide Island, first ship out of Hope Bay to Adelaide Island. The plan was that I was going to be flown back to the area to do some more work in the summer. And we sat at Adelaide Island. It must have been mid-December through to January, and the planes just didn't get us over there. It seems that there's a weather barrier, and good weather on one side meant bad weather on the other side. And so I had quite a nice time at Adelaide Island. Spent some time helping to build a hut. Got myself a flight down to Fossil Bluff. And as co-pilot, you know, the pilots like company, so go sit in the co-pilot seat, and going back, the pilot said, "Oh, I need to have a fag. Take the controls." So that's the one and only time I've flown a plane.
How was it?
Oh, it was great. I had a little bit of trouble maintaining height and so on, but it was
important, isn't it, to maintain height?
Yeah. But, well, he was sitting next to me. I'm sure he'd have grabbed the controls if it was going too far wrong. He just had to keep it on the heading and altitude. And
was that an indication of the kind of attitude towards that kind of thing?
Oh, I'm sure it was, yeah.
At the time.
I'm sure that certainly wouldn't be allowed now, anything like that.
Let's just go back to the Eliassons then. Because
yeah.
Did they prove to be that reliable or not?
No, we had a lot of problems with them. They weren't very well made. Like, you had the track, and that was running on wooden runners.
Wooden?
So, yeah. So with the friction, they didn't last too long. Had problems starting. And they didn't really do the job we expected, which was to pull more weight on sledges than dogs could carry. In good conditions, they could just about do it. But once the snow got soft, or you started going up a gradient, they just didn't. And you couldn't traverse with them, go along a slope, because just sliding down is so difficult. Well, it's difficult with dogs anyway. But the one time I felt that they really did succeed was getting stuff up Soda Bread Slope. I don't know if you come across this anyway. 1 in 3 slope. And it's a real problem getting stuff up. The one time they did succeed was when... It's my idea, I claim it.
But
just take the license, just by themselves, put a couple of boxes on it, and the driver, and just drive up. And that worked very well. I mean, spent the day taking everything up, a box at a time. As the dogs can barely get the sledge up, let alone any payload, and people have tried pulleys and all sorts. So that did actually work well. But other times, not so well. And then there's one famous occasion, it's in Fuchs's of Dogs and Men, where he hasn't got it quite right, but what happened was, it was a very cold morning actually, it was minus 35, and this was March, and we used to warm them up first, start the engine, drive them around, warm them up. Pete was driving his, hit a bump, and it threw him off, and it cleared off towards the horizon. And of course, we'd filled the fuel tank up, it went 12 miles before it stopped.
Did you ever see it again?
Oh yeah, yeah, that's how we knew how far it had gone. It just had to go out in the other one and bring it back. But, of course, that was a couple of hours' delay, I suppose, while that was done.
So was the attitude towards them then to not use them very much? Because they weren't so reliable, they weren't that useful?
They weren't keen to use them, but the way the field trip was planned, we had to use them. And there's a lot of opposition from the dogmen. I didn't have a dog team of my own. I was always second man. But the dog drivers are very anti, and they felt that they're much more liable or at risk in crevassed areas. You know, dogs will just jump over, or if the first one goes down, the rest of them stop. Except for one instance I'll tell you about, if you like. yeah, there was that, and the unreliability, starting them in the morning, but just breaking down, or bits, you know, especially the belt drive thing, that was constantly giving trouble. So on my main trip the second year when we were using them, we used them to do the depot run. But then the main trip, left in September, there were 6 of us on that with two dog teams, 2 Eliassons, I think it was. And one of the Eliassons, it made it to the depot, and then on the first trip out up into the sort of hinterland, it just broke down terminally, and it's still there.
Oh,
and I at least managed to drive mine for the full 1,000 miles or so, which I was quite pleased about that, and got it back to 3 slice Nunatak, and left it there for the next group to come out, and that's probably still there now as well.
Was there a sense when these machines arrived that the dog era was being threatened? Were the dogmen
they certainly felt threatened. I think a lot of them didn't really believe it would happen. I must admit, I could see the writing was on the wall for the dogs. The construction of this thing was so poor, but seeing the machines they've got now, then I think it was inevitable. Never mind the reason, you know, the dogs were taken out anyway. That was because they're not indigenous species. That's a separate issue. But I think it would have come anyway.
And they realised that the dog men spotted that, did they?
I think they spotted it, but didn't want to accept it. Mm. You know, just called them all sorts of names, like Eliasson became Elsan. You know, the the toilet system that he used. We called it that.
You were going to tell me a story about the dogs.
Oh yeah, this is another crevasse incident. That's in Of Dogs and Men.
Kevin's book.
Yeah, it's referred to in that. Coming back, this was back from my main trip at Stonington, virtually the end of my sledging days, actually. We crossed the plateau, we'd gone up Bill's Gulch and crossing the plateau, coming down into the amphitheatre, and just where the lip goes over, all of a sudden, we found ourselves running parallel to a crevasse, which of course is not the done thing, but you do get caught out sometimes, and the lead dog went down, and the next pair, next pair, next pair. And they all went down, just like a zip faster, and threw the sledge over, so that didn't go over. And luckily we did manage to get the dogs out. I think it was Ben Hodges that I think went down and brought them up, because they had to be brought up one at a time. We couldn't heave the whole lot up. It wasn't a particularly wide crevasse, but it was wide enough to take the dogs.
Wide enough to take Ben, wasn't
he? Yeah, he managed to get down, yeah. So I think it was probably about 3 foot or so.
You were on the other end of the rope, were you?
There were all six of us there, so I was just the mere geologist, but we had people who were much more experienced with ropes, like Ron Tyndall. Ian McMurrin had done quite a bit, I think, as well. So I'm afraid I just stood and watched, because there's only room for one to go down and a couple of people on top. So I wasn't very much involved in that.
How was Ben chosen, or did he choose himself?
It was his team, so I think that's probably the main thing. And he was a general assistant anyway, but he was a builder by trade rather than a mountaineer. But I'm pretty sure it was him that went down.
It was,
yes. Yeah. But yeah. He got
there was no question of not getting the dogs back.
No. No, I think, we knew they were all alive and kicking and fighting, the two pairs, as they do. So there's no question of anything else. And just rolled up their sleeves and got on with it.
One or two of them fell out of their harnesses, I believe.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. I couldn't remember that, actually, but reading the write-up. There's the other book. In fact, it might be worth your while trying to get it if you can. When Of Dogs and Men was written, people sent things in, and a lot of it didn't make it. And I think it's called The Book That Never Was. And there are a few copies of those floating around. You know, you might pick up some interesting information in that.
Apart from the dogs being threatened by mechanical snowmobiles, what other significant changes did you have taken place over time?
Between then and now?
Yeah.
Well, I think the big difference is that a lot of the field work's done in the summer. In my time, the summer was for unloading the ships and then get them out of the way, and the sea ice to form, and then you go and do your field work. But now, I'm thinking of Rotherhithe. I'm not so sure about Halley Bay because that's Halley now, isn't it? Mm. But not so sure quite how they operate, but certainly Rotherhithe. People fly in for the summer and then almost immediately fly up to their field area and they're left there for the summer and then fly back. There's no question of sea ice or anything like that. So I think the work is much more intensive now than ever ours was. Much more efficient, of course, but not so much fun.
How would you say the improvement in communications has changed, or not only changed the way the experience of going south, but also who gets chosen?
Who gets chosen to go south?
Well, I'm thinking now that compared to you were being selected because you were going south, you're going to be alone and isolated for 2 or 3 years.
Mm.
Now you can ring your mates.
Yeah, you can. I think they have satellite phones and email and all the rest of it now. And so I probably even talking about email on in a tent, but they've probably got I'm sure they have satellite phones. So they're in constant contact all the time. So, yeah, they can contact one another. And I,
does that change the nature of being a FID?
Oh, I think it does. One of the things was the total isolation. You know, the 100 words a month. Or is it 200 words a month coming in? 100, you've probably got this anyway.
100 going out.
100 going out. Hard work writing them. So, and very little contact otherwise. A very little idea what was going on in the outside world. I heard that Kennedy was assassinated.
How did
he hear? It was on the field trip, and we used to tune into Voice of America. We'd get the radio out. We didn't use it much because the batteries weren't very efficient. But we'd get it out and get it going, and maybe waiting for the Skedworth base. And so tune into Voice of America and just heard that come through. Couldn't believe it.
How do you respond to that? Because some other FIDs were quite deeply affected by tragedies in the world.
Yeah, I wouldn't say affected. I was really shocked and surprised by it, but okay, well, that's happened. And there's the bit about the Russians installing their rockets in Cuba and and being told to get lost. I think that happened just as I was about to go down, because I seem to know a bit about that. But I can't really remember anything else. Oh, one thing I do remember is a very cold winter of, I think, 63. But that was information coming from home via the ships rather than the radio. So really, in terms of communication, we're almost completely cut off.
Yeah, one or two of the FIDs said they felt powerless. They were listening into what was happening, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the Iron Curtain going up.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I felt I'm glad I'm in the Southern Hemisphere if anything does go off. But if those things did go off, well, I don't know what would happen. But that was the only thing I felt about that.
You weren't worried there might not be a world to go back to?
Well, I did cross my mind. I didn't think it would be like that. But if there wasn't a world to go back to, would we be able to get back anyway? So, because the ships wouldn't come down if the world had been destroyed. But no, I didn't. That didn't really concern me as a real possibility, just a vague possibility, that was all.
Back of the mind job.
Yeah, it was there. You know, I was enjoying myself, I'll carry on like this and make the most of it. If the Northern Hemisphere gets blown up, well, so be it.
Yeah. What about health and safety? Were you very conscious of being safe and secure at all times?
Health and safety in the sense that we've got now.
Yeah,
I think they've gone way over the top. Well, there's so many risks with sledging. You know, sea ice, the tents blowing away, the crevasses. Quite a few times when I did wonder whether the tent was going to survive the current storm. And, of course, crevasses as well. Would we, you know, get... There's one got my name on it. I was always aware of that. But there wasn't much you could do about it.
Did you follow the guidance all the time? Or were chances taken, risks taken?
Well, I think sometimes when you got to get from A to B and there's a crevasse in the way, then you may have to go over it. No choice. So a lot of it was you just had to do it. And sometimes the risks were pretty obvious. And you didn't have a choice. You just accepted that as part of what we were doing.
I mean, you weren't prepared to die for your work, though, were you?
Oh, no, that wasn't the intention. No, things like, you know, I always made sure I was attached to the sledge. You know, we had the waistband and the hook over the handle. I made sure I had that when we were in crevasses. And if I suspected crevasses at all, when the sledge got to where I was going to work, it'd park and wouldn't park right next to the rock. I'd have to cover some distance. They always wear skis. And a couple of times might have roped up in case. So, you know, quite sensible about that. I didn't really climb up at all. Virtually all the geology was the bottom bit of rock, the first bit I could get to, the easiest bit. Still, I quite often had to get across the Bergschrund.
What?
A Bergschrund, that's where you got the ice fixed to the rock, but it tends to pull away And it doesn't pull away by the rock, it pulls away and leaves a crevasse parallel to the rock face. And I had to get over those, and and wind scoops could be interesting. Where the wind had blown round, you have a deep, smooth scoop that you had to negotiate as well. I don't think they're dangerous. You might have just slipped down and think, oh, how do I get out? But no, that would be all right because of people with ropes to pull you out. But it's just a slide down.
What did you think of the wildlife down there?
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. All the penguins. And of course, I'd got a cine camera like so many people had, and so I was filming the penguins and taking. I'd learned how to develop black and white pictures, so I was doing those. So, yeah, I spent a lot of time with them.
Were you killing seals?
Yeah.
And what was that for a geologist?
I was quite comfortable with that. I'd been used to catching and killing rabbits, so it came okay. And yeah, I knew we had to do it to feed the dogs. And also, I was a lot more bloodthirsty then than I am now. But I tried eating most of the things there. I tried penguins, tried skuas, cormorants, fish, tried all those. It's a bit of fresh meat for the diet. Mm. Of course, you can't do that now. There's something else that people miss going down now. Couldn't even think about even touching anything, any of the wildlife, let alone killing it for food.
And also, of course, these days, concerned about the retreat of the ice.
Mm. Yeah, well, I've been back twice, this century, the 2003-2005, and there's really... really find it depressing, especially Hope Bay. You know, the ice has just vanished. And the other thing that's depressing is the spread of the orange Argentine huts everywhere. So, and Stonington, I don't know if you know Stonington, but you got the island. In my day, you could go straight up a ramp onto the northeast glacier. But now that glacier has retreated 100 metres or so. So it's very definitely an island. And it's very depressing. But I did find it difficult to relate the two things. There's Stonington in the 60s and Stonington now. Quite different things.
You went back twice this decade?
Yeah.
On tourist ships? Or?
Well, the first one was called the Last Memorial Foundation trip. It was a Scandinavian trip. The object was to retrace Captain Larsen's route when he lost his ship just off the east of the peninsula and got beset in ice, and it was part of the Nordenskjold trip and Snow Hill Island, part of that one. And the plan was to go back, retrace his steps, and have a ceremony where the ship sank. And it was arranged by the two great-great-grandsons of Captain Larsen. And they traced a lot of people, or the descendants of a lot of the people who were either on the ship or part of Nordenskjold's expedition. And they offered it to the Hope Bay people. And four of us went. There's Brian Hunt and Roger Robson are here as well. And Mike Thompson. And the others were the descendants and interested people. And there's half a dozen Czech people. I think they're just filling up a few spaces with them. So that was the first one. Went back there. So that covered Hope Bay. And I thought, oh, well, I've been back. And then the Marguerite Bay 2005 trip came up, and I went on that. And luckily for me, the last one covered Hope Bay. This was otherwise known as Stonington and Bust, or Bust, because I wanted to go to Stonington. And the two complemented one another really well, because they covered quite different areas, but mainly they covered my two bases. So I went on that.
What were your feelings as you cruised back towards Stonington and saw the current stage of play?
Yeah, it suddenly appeared. We arrived early in the morning and went out and, we're there. And it was a lovely day, actually. Cloudy at first, then it cleared. And there'd been fresh fall of snow, so everything was nice and clean and pristine with the fresh fall of snow. But the base... very disappointing because it had been extended since I was there, and it was really quite a mess. There was nothing left inside it, And that was very depressing to see it in that state. And I thought there was a great pity. I managed to find my old pit there and look around, but it wasn't what I expected. And that's the reason I didn't actually go on the Millennium trip. I thought, well, you know, should I keep my memories of the 60s, keep them that way? But then my curiosity got the better of me and I went on these other two.
When I say the pit, what do you mean by your pit?
My bed.
Oh, your bed.
Bed, the pit, yeah.
Okay.
Mm. Yeah, so I found that. But, yeah, it seemed very strange. I would have liked to have had longer to look around more, especially at Hope Bay. Stonington was just the island, so we couldn't go very far. But Hope Bay, I would have liked to have had more time to get further afield, go up to Nobby Nunatak and round to Depot Glacier, that sort of thing. But the four-hour rule applied, and you know about the four-hour. Oh, well, tourist ships, they can only put 100 people ashore at any one time and for a maximum of 4 hours. So that rather restricts you. I think as FIDs we had a bit more leeway than the normal tourists, but even so, it would have been nice to have longer. So, yeah, I've got mixed feelings. I'm glad I went. I doubt if I'll go again. The only reason I might go again is if something goes down the east coast where I was working, and especially if it can go to my Fleet Point. I think I mentioned that in the,
yeah, the previous point.
Yeah, Fleet Point, yeah.
Why that particular spot?
Well, because it's Fleet Point, and I didn't...
No, why was that spot called Fleet Point?
Oh, why? I don't know, actually.
It wasn't one that you...
It wasn't where I was working. There was a place up in Starbuck Glacier, a nice granite bluff. I thought, well, if they're going to name something after me, I want... that. I want Fleet Bluff. But I had absolutely no say in it. And I didn't actually find out till, I think it's 1997. I think it'd been put on the map long before then. But I was never told. And talking to other people, most people aren't told. They just find out. Because most of my contemporaries do have something named after them. Like Ben Hodges, he's got Hodges Point. But they just find out, and in some cases I've had the pleasure of telling people, oh, you've like Pete Kennett, he didn't know. And
it's a bit bizarre that you're not told, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. And I've had the pleasure of telling them, because I've while researching for details on my point, I've found out other people's points. And now there's a digital map with all the names on and the gazetteer and so on, so it's easier to find out now. That's all come out since.
Was there any indication back in the 60s that the snow and the ice were beginning to retreat?
I don't think so, no. We did think, well, the summers are unusually warm, but I think somewhere like Hope Bay you get these fern winds that come down, very warm winds, and there's a certain seasonal variability anyway, so not really, no. I don't think we're conscious of that at all.
Looking back over your life as a whole,
how
important now is that period of time in the Antarctic?
Oh, it's very important to have that experience. I didn't, when I got back, I sort of drifted away from things. Once I'd written things up, went to Canada, and then I came back and worked in the water industry. I don't know if I put that, but that's what I did anyway. And I'd always kept some... sort of remote interest in what was going on, but I wasn't involved in any reunions. And it was the Hope Bay reunion, I'm not sure the date, but it must be 15 years ago, and then there's a big one, and I was found. No, in fact, what happened was there was a talk at the Royal Geographical Society about the last dogs coming out of the Antarctic, and John Killingbeck was giving that. May not be a name you know, but
yeah.
Oh, you do, yeah. And he had a sledge there, and Princess Anne was there, and I went, and I recognised Ben Hodges, because I hadn't been in touch at all, and sort of went over and spoke to him, and he told me about these various reunions going on, and then the next thing was the big Hope Bay reunion. We got a high proportion of the people, and from there, I've joined in with the Marguerite Bay reunion group. And the Bass Club. And I'm in the Antarctic Club, but that's too stiff and starchy for me, so I don't I don't go to the meetings, but with those three, yeah, I go to most of them now. And it's a big thing in my life. The only thing is, it happened right at the beginning of my career. You know, having done that, well, what can beat that? Nothing can beat it.
You understand how Neil Armstrong feels, do you?
Oh, very much so, yeah. And actually, I qualified as an amateur diver, and I did some voluntary coral reef surveys in Belize. There's a thing called Coral Key Conservation. Did 2 months there, and come back and sort of post trip brief. And wasn't that the most exciting thing you've ever done in your life? And for everyone else, it would be. But I'd say, no, it's not. It's the Antarctic. And I'm sure you understood. But
can you put your finger on why the Antarctic experience is so special?
I think maybe partly the age group, because it was the first major thing. I'd like to liken it to a lot of the old soldiers, First World War soldiers. They have similar feelings. And I think it's the hardship together at a young age. If this had happened when I was in my 50s and I'd done other things, it might not have had the same effect. So I think I was at an age when I was very receptive to that sort of thing. But it was what I did, the isolation, the very special, just doing it. And being isolated for the 2 winters.
Was it in any way a spiritual experience? You were dealing with the very early stages of creation, weren't you?
I suppose so, yeah. And going to places that nobody had been to before, that was very special. Although the odd thing was, I'd go up a glacier and I'd think, oh, nobody's been here before. Oh, so what? But now I've come back and I can think back to being on that glacier or that spot, then I think, well, you know, that's rather special, isn't it? The first person to ever go to that particular area. But at the time, it didn't feel special because it's, all right, it's just a bit of snow and I'm standing on it. But, yeah, the whole experience, I think.
You have a polar medal.
I do, yeah.
Mike?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, that's what puzzled me. My impression was that in the early days, everyone got them. And then they started thinning out. Well, there's so many people going south. So they started thinning out. There was a round of polar medals given out soon after I got back. And I wasn't on the list. So I thought, oh, well, that's it. I'm not on the list. Then 4 years later, there was another batch. It was 12 people. And I was on the list. And I worked it out. The chances were, of the people who had been down in that period, about 400 people had been south and would otherwise be eligible. So it's 12 in 400 chance. And I was talking to somebody at one of the reunions. And I think why I got it was I overwintered. I did major sledging trips. And I stayed on afterwards to write it all up. I think those are the main... And I was a good boy and got on with people and behaved myself. I think those were the main criteria. And that's what I was told. And the same thing with the Fleet Point.
Did you go to Buckingham Palace?
Yeah, I did, and got it from the Queen Mum.
The Queen Mum?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, so she's always been special since that. That was a very special day. I was by myself. We didn't all 12 went up at separate times. So I don't know what reason it... Mine was come out in as part of the New Year's Honours list. And so I went up and they start with the, you know, the knighthoods at the top. And the polar medal was the very last, the lowliest of the medals. But so I had to do something slightly different at the end because people troop up, get the medal and troop off. I had to back off, do a bell. And I think I may have had to wait until she went back again. But it's still, yeah, that's very special. Very proud to get
Mike,
that.
Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Good. Hope you find it of interest.